Mein Kampf, Volume 1, An Accounting, Chapter 2, Years of Learning and Suffering in Vienna. When my mother died, fate had already made its decision. During the last months of her life, I went to Vienna to take the entrance examination for the academy. Armed with a thick bundle of drawings, I was convinced I would find the examination mere child's play. In a secondary school, I was by far the best draftsman in my class. Since that time, my ability had only improved. My own satisfaction in my ability led me to hope for the best. There was one single fly in the ointment. My talent for painting was frequently exceeded by my ability as a draftsman, especially in architecture. My interest in architecture kept growing. My interest accelerated when I visited Vienna for a couple of weeks before I turned 16. I went to the art gallery of the Court Museum and found I had eyes almost solely for the museum itself. From early morning until late at night, I trotted from one site to another, but only the buildings really held my attention. I could stand for hours looking at the Opera House and for hours admire the Parliament buildings. The Ringstrasse, a circular street in the old town section of Vienna, in parenthesis, section seemed like an enchantment from the stories out of A Thousand and One Nights. I was now in the beautiful city for the second time. I waited for the results of my entrance exam as I was filled with excitement, impatience, and proud confidence. I was so certain of success that when I received a rejection, it struck me like a bolt from the blue. And yet, that was it, period. When I called on the head of the academy and asked the reason why I had not been admitted to the School of Painting, he assured me that my drawings showed I had no aptitude for painting and that my true ability was in the field of architecture. The School of Painting was out of the question, but the School of Architecture was for me, even though at first they found it difficult to believe that I had never attended an architectural school or had any instruction in architecture. As I left Hansen's magnificent building on the square, I was at odds with myself for the first time in my young life. What I had just been told about my abilities was like a lightning flash illuminating an unexplainable confusion in me that had been growing for some time. Within a few days, I knew I would be an architect someday. I could see the path before me would be enormously difficult. Everything I had been too stubborn to learn in secondary school was now taking its bitter revenge. Admission to the Vienna Academy School of Architecture required attendance of the Building School of Technology, and admission here was based on graduation and the final exams from an intermediate school. I did not have either. It seemed my dream of art was now impossible. After the death of my mother, I returned to Vienna, this time to stay for some years. I once again regained my calm and determination. My earlier spirit of defiance had also returned, and I was determined to reach my goal. I would be an architect. Obstacles exist to be overcome, and I would overcome those obstacles with the image of my father before my eyes. He fought his way from a farm boy and shoemaker to state official, and my soil was richer than his, so my battle should be that much easier. What had then seemed to me to be the unkindness of fate, I accept as the wisdom of providence. When the goddess of trouble embraced me and often threatened to crush me, the will to resist grew, and at last that will was victorious. That period made me strong. I thank her for snatching me from the emptiness of a comfortable life and for pulling this mama's boy out of the comfortable, cozy bed with his tendies. I was reluctantly thrown into the world of misery and poverty, which introduced me to those I would later fight for. That is the point when I saw two dangers approaching. Previously, I did not truly understand their names or their importance to the German people's existence. Their names were Marxism and Jewry. Vienna is widely considered the very essence of innocence and bliss, as the festive home of happy crowds. It has turned into a constant reminder of the saddest period of my life. Even today, the city stirs only gloomy thoughts in me. 5 years of misery and wretchedness are encapsulated in the name of this Phaeacian city. Phaeacia is the final city visited by Homer in the Odyssey. However, it is also a common knowledge reference in Germany and something any German would recognize. The belief is that the people liked to enjoy life, and the reference means a city of loafers or do-nothings or parasites, in parenthesis. For 5 years, I had to earn my bread, and as a small painter, my bread was meager at best. It was never enough to satisfy my hunger. In those days, hunger was my faithful sidekick who never left me. When I bought a book, he shared it with me. A trip to the opera would give me his company for days. It was a never-ending battle with my unsympathetic friend. In those lean days, I learned faster than I ever learned before. Besides my architecture and a rare ticket to the opera, books were my only remaining pleasure. I read voraciously. I used any free time I found to study. After a few years, I was able to lay the foundations of a knowledge which I still live on today. At that time, I formed an image and a concept of the world which had become the rock-solid foundation of my present political activity. Since that time, I needed only to learn a little beyond what I had already assembled because I found there was nothing in my image that required changing. On the contrary, today I firmly believe that all creative ideas usually appear in youth if they exist at all. I must distinguish this from the wisdom of age, which is a thoroughness and caution forced by the experiences of a long life. This is different from the genius of youth, who pours out unending thoughts and ideas while their great number prevents them from being developed. This youthful genius furnishes the foundation from which an older and wiser man can build stones into a structure. At least, that is the case if the so-called wisdom of age does not choke the genius of youth. My early home life differed little from the home life of others. I could watch for the next day without a care and without any problems to worry over. My youth was spent in lower middle-class circles. That is to say, I was in a world that was not in contact with those who worked at pure physical labor. Strange as it may seem at first glance, economic differences between this level and that of ditch diggers is often deeper than one thinks. This antagonism comes from a social group which has just recently lifted itself from the ranks of physical labor and is afraid it could fall back, or at least be counted as one of them. There is often a repulsive memory of cultural poverty among this lower middle class, so any social contact with physical laborers, which they feel they have outgrown, becomes unbearable. A man from the higher social levels can mix with worker classes in a way that would be thinkable to the relative newcomers of this lower middle class. A newcomer to a social class is anyone who fights his way by his own energy from one position in life to a higher one. But eventually, this bitter battle kills off human sympathy for the class he escaped. One's own painful struggle for existence destroys his feelings for the misery of those left behind. In this respect, fate took pity on me. By forcing me back into the world of poverty and insecurity which my father had once abandoned, the blinders of a limited lower-middle-class education were removed from my eyes. Only then did I learn how to distinguish between a hollow or brutal man's exterior and his inner nature. In the early years of this century, Vienna was among the most socially unhealthy of cities. It was a combination of glittering wealth and revolting poverty. In the center of the inner districts, one felt the heartbeat of an empire of 52 million people, along with the dangerous magic of this state of mixed nationalities. The blinding magnificence of this cultural and government center was like a magnet to the wealth and intelligence of the state. On top of that came the extreme centralization of the Habsburg monarchy. It offered the only possibility of holding this stew of people together. The result was an extraordinary concentration of high government offices in the capital and around imperial residence. Vienna was not only the political and intellectual center, but also the economic capital of the old Danube monarchy. In contrast with the army of high officers, officials, artists, and scholars were a larger army of workers who were against the wealth of the aristocracy and their practice of bleeding poverty for all they could. The palaces of the Ringstrasse became a waiting room for thousands of the unemployed, and below the Arc de Triomphe Of old Austria, the homeless lived in the twilight and slime of the sewers. There was not one German city where the social situation could have been better studied than in Vienna. Do not be misled. This studying, cannot be done from above. Someone who has not been in the clutches of this viper cannot truly know its venom. Studying from above results in superficial chatter or the formation of false opinions based on emotion. Both are harmful. One, because it can never really reach the heart of the problem. The other, because it passes by the problem entirely. I do not know which is more devastating, to ignore those who lack the basic necessities, such as we see in those who are favored by fortune or live well as a result of their own effort, or is it those who stand tall in their fashionable skirts or trousers and feel for the people, because it is the latest fad? In any case, these people commit a sin greater than their limited intelligence will ever allow them to understand. Then they are astonished when their fashionable social conscience, which they proudly display, never produces any results. When their fruitless good intentions are resented, they blame the ingratitude of the people. People with minds like this fail to understand that there is no place for merely social activities. When the masses want results, social displays are not enough, and there can be no exception of gratitude, or excuse me, be no expectation of gratitude for such a show. It is not a matter of distributing favors, but of retribution and justice. I did not learn about the social problem by observing it from the outside. It drew me into its magic circle of suffering, and instead of teaching me, it sought to test its strength on me, and it receives no credit if I survived its test safe and sound. I could never completely relate my sensations from that time. I can only describe the essential and most staggering impressions here, along with the lessons I learned. I rarely had any difficulty finding work. I was not a skilled worker, but had to earn my bread as best I could, so I did so as a helper or day laborer. I had the attitude of the laborers of Europe, who shake the dust from their feet with their determination to build a new life and a new home in the New World. The New World means the United States, which was receiving a large number of immigrants at the time, in parentheses. They are free from preconceived notions of occupation and social background, of status and tradition, and they grasp any means of support that is offered them. They go to any job and gradually arrive at the realization that honest labor is no disgrace, no matter what kind of labor it may be. I, too, was determined to leap with both feet into a world that was new to me and to find my way through it. I soon learned that someone always needs some kind of work. But I learned just as quickly how easy it is to lose that support again. The insecurity of one's daily bread soon became one of the darkest aspects of my new life. The skilled worker is turned out on the street less often than the unskilled, but even he can be pushed out the door. Instead of losing his job because he is not needed, he is locked out, or he strikes. This dependence reveals a weakness in the whole economic system. The peasant boy who is drawn to the big city by the promise of easier work and shorter hours is accustomed to a certain amount of security. He has never left one job without having another, or at least the prospect of another, lined up. As more boys are drawn to the city, the shortage of farm labor takes its toll and the chance of being unemployed increases. Now, it would be a mistake to think that the young fellow who goes to the city is made of sterner stuff than the one who stays home and makes an honest living from the soil. No, quite to the contrary. Experience shows that emigrant groups are more likely to be made up of the healthiest and most energetic individuals, and these emigrants include not only the man who goes to America, but also the young farmhand who leaves his native village to move to the distant big city. He is just as prepared for an uncertain fate as the farm boy going to another country. Usually, he comes to town with a little change in his pocket to last him at least a day if he does not immediately find work. However, his situation will quickly worsen if he finds a job, then loses that job at the wrong time. Finding a new job as a worker can be almost impossible in winter months. For the first few weeks, he receives unemployment benefits from his union and does his best to survive. But when his last penny is gone, and the union benefits expire, he then finds himself in a difficult position. He walks the streets as his stomach growls, perhaps pawns or sells his last possessions. His clothes become fewer in number and worse in condition, which drags down his appearance. Soon he finds himself in surroundings that corrupt him not only physically, but spiritually. If he then becomes homeless in winter, his suffering becomes even more intense. Eventually, he is able to find some sort of work under a union, but then the game begins all over again. He is hit a second time with unemployment in the form of a strike. Then a third time may be even worse. Gradually, he learns to become indifferent to the constant insecurity of his finances. The cycle changes into a habit that he continues without further consideration. We now have an otherwise hard-working man whose attitude towards life grows slack and gradually matures him into a tool of those unions who will merely use him to gain their own advantage. He has so frequently switched between working and non-working through no fault of his own that he no longer notices whether the strike in which he takes part will secure him any economic rights, or whether it is an attempt to destroy the state, the whole social order, and even civilization itself. He may not like the idea of going on strike, but he is completely indifferent when he is handed strike papers. I have watched this process 1,000 times with my own eyes. The longer I saw the game continue, the more I disliked the city of millions. It greedily sucks men in, then cruelly wears them to pieces. When men came to the city, they still belonged to their nation. When they stayed, they were lost to it. Life threw me around in the great city, too. I felt the full force of such a fate, body and soul. I discovered something else as well, quickly switching between periods of work and unemployment, along with the seesawing of income and expenses, eventually destroyed many people's sense of thrift and intelligent planning. The body becomes accustomed to living high in good times and starving in bad. They no longer make any effort to plan sensibly in good times, for the bad times they know will come. Indifference surrounds its victim with a mirage which makes them see only well-fed prosperity, regardless of their true circumstances. This mirage grows into such morbid intensity that they give up all self-control the moment wages begin to flow into their pocket. This is why a man who has difficulty finding any work stupidly forgets to plan for bad times when he does find work. He instead lives greedily and indulges in the moment. His tiny weekly income is instantly spent because he does not even plan for the remainder of the week. At first, his wages last 5 days, instead of 7, then only 3, then scarcely a day, to be at last squandered the first evening. These men are not all living by life by themselves. They likely have a wife and children at home. Their family is also poisoned by this way of life, especially if the man is naturally kind to them and even loves them in his way. Before the week's pay has evaporated in 2 to 3 days, they eat and drink as long as the money holds out. Then they go through the remaining days together on empty stomachs. Then the wife slinks about the neighborhood, borrowing a bit here and there, opening charge accounts with the shopkeepers, and trying thus to survive the terrible later days of the week. At noon, they all sit at a table which does not contain enough for everyone, if it contains anything at all. They sit, waiting for the next payday, talking of it, making plans. While they starve, they are already lost in the mirage of the good fortune which comes on payday. The children, even in their youngest days, will come to see this wretched life of empty fantasy as normal. The situation can become worse if the man lives like this and the wife objects for the sake of the children. Then there are quarrels and bad blood, and the more the husband drifts apart from his wife, the nearer he drifts to alcohol. Every Saturday, he becomes drunk. Now, his wife must fight for the few pennies she can snatch from him in an effort of self-preservation for herself and the children. What she can get is only what is left over from his journey between the factory and the bar. When he finally comes home on Sunday or Monday night, drunk, brutal, and penniless, there are likely to be scenes that would wring tears from a stone. I saw all of this going on in hundreds of cases. At first, I was disgusted or outraged. I later came to realize the tragedy of the suffering and to understand its deeper causes. They were the unhappy victims of evil circumstances. The housing conditions of those days were worse. The housing situation of the Viennese labor was absolutely frightful. I shudder now when I think of those wretched caverns some lived in, of the houses where journeymen of a common trade lived together, and mass dormitories which were sinister pictures of refuse filled with disgusting filth and worse. It was bound to happen. The flood of slaves, set loose from these squalid caves, pours down upon the rest of the world, upon its thoughtless fellow men. It is bound to happen again. This other world lets things drift without thinking about the consequences. It has lost its instinct to tell it that sooner or later, fate will move toward retribution unless mankind placates destiny before time runs out. I am indeed thankful to a providence for sending me to that school of hard knocks in the city. There, I could not sabotage what I did not like. I had to quickly grow up. If I wanted to avoid falling into despair because of the people who surrounded me, I had to learn the distinctions between their outer character and inner life and the circumstances that created their lives. Only through this understanding could I bear it all without giving up to despair. It was no longer human beings who rose before me out of unhappiness and misery, out of squalor and physical degradation, but the sad product of sad laws. At the same time, my own fight for life, which was no easier than theirs, preserved me from becoming emotionally involved with the products of this ill society, and allowed me to remain objective. No, emotional sentimentality will not help understanding here. Even then, I saw that only a twofold path could lead to the improvement of such conditions. I experienced a deep feeling of social responsibility to establish a better system for our development. I knew it would require brutal determination and to destroy this human outgrowth which had no chance of being preserved and corrected. Nature does not focus on preserving what exists. Nature concentrates on breeding a new generation to perpetuate the species. It is almost impossible for a man to improve those bad things that exist in society, but it is much easier to create healthier paths from the start. Even during my struggle for existence in Vienna, I realized the task of improving social elements could never be a frivolous welfare scheme. They are ridiculous and useless. Instead, we must overcome the fundamental weaknesses in the organization of our economic and cultural life. The holes in the system are bound to lead to the perversion of individuals, or at least they are capable of doing so. Wavering judgment is the enemy that will halt our advance when we need to use the most brutal weapons against a criminal group that is hostile to the state. This uncertainty results from a feeling of personal guilt and responsibility for the tragic decline of society. Uncertainty cripples any serious and firm resolve, and results in opinions swaying from one side to the other, leaving any decision that is made weak and half done, even when it comes to the most essential measures of self-preservation. Only when there comes an age not haunted by the shadow of its own guilt will there be both the inward calm and the outer strength, which can brutally and ruthlessly prune the dead limbs and uproot the weeds in our society's garden. The Austrian state had no real social legislation or system for administration of justice at all. Its weakness in suppressing even the worst abuses was obvious to everyone. I do not know what horrified me more, the economic misery of my neighbors, their moral weakness, or the low state of their intellectual development. How often does our social class rise up in righteous indignation when it hears some wretched tramp say he does not care whether he is German or not? He says that he is equally happy anywhere so long as he has what he needs to live on. This lack of national pride should be deeply condemned, and such statements should be loudly admonished. How many have actually asked themselves why their own way of thinking is better? How many realize there are countless reminders of the grandeur of the fatherland in every field of culture and art? When these reminders are combined, those affected have a justified pride in belonging to such a fortunate people. Pride in the fatherland is built on knowing about its greatness in all these fields. Have the members of our social class noticed that this knowledge, which is needed to instill pride for the fatherland, is not available to the people? We cannot use the excuse that it is the same in other countries, because the worker in other countries has no difficulty holding on to his nationality. Even if this were so, it would be no excuse for one's own shortcomings. The French people teach France's greatness in every department of culture, or, as the Frenchman says, of civilization, and we foolishly dismiss it as a fanatical glorification in their upbringing. The young Frenchman is simply not trained to be objective, but instead he is given a subjective attitude of greatness anywhere the political or cultural aspect of his fatherland is concerned. This type of education has to be widespread, and if necessary, it must be pounded into the people's memories and feelings by perpetual repetition. With us, there is both the sin of omission and a destruction of what little we were lucky enough to learn in school. The rats infecting our political system gnaw even the tiny bit we have learned out of the hearts and memories of our people. Poverty and wretchedness have also done their share to crush these memories. Here is an example. In a basement consisting of two stuffy rooms lives a laborer's family of seven. Among the five children is a boy of 3 years. This is the age when a child first becomes conscious of things around him. Gifted people carry memories of that period far into old age. The small, overcrowded space produces an unfortunate situation. The conditions often generate quarrels and bickering. The people are not living with one another, they are merely living in the same place, squeezed together. Every small argument leads to a sickening quarrel. In a larger dwelling, the argument would be easily smoothed out simply by separation. The children may tolerate these conditions because children can quarrel constantly and forget the argument quickly. However, a daily battle between parents slowly teaches the child a lesson. The dispute may take the form of a father's brutality to a mother, of drunken maltreatment. Any person who does not know of this life can hardly imagine it. By the time the boy goes from 3 to 6, he has developed a working idea of the world which must horrify even an adult. Now he is morally infected and physically undernourished, and the young citizen is sent to primary school with vermin living in his poor little scalp. Now, with great difficulty, he must learn reading and writing, and that is about all he can manage. Studying at home is out of the question. Father and mother argue and use language that would not be socially appropriate right in front of their own children, making studying impossible. But when the parents talk to teachers and school officials, they are more inclined to talk roughly to them than to turn their young child over their knee and introduce him to reason. Nothing the little fellow hears at home strengthens his respect for his fellow human beings. They never utter a good word about humanity. No institution is safe from their profane attacks, from the school teacher to the head of state. No matter whether it is religion or morals, state or society, everything is defamed and dragged in the muck. When the boy leaves school at the age of 14, it is hard to tell which is greater, his incredible stupidity where common knowledge and basic skills are concerned, or his biting disrespect and bad manners. The immoral displays, even at that age, make one's hair stand on end. He holds almost nothing sacred. He has never met true greatness, but he has experienced the abyss of everyday life. What position can he possibly occupy in the world which he is about to enter? The 3-year-old has become a 15-year-old who despises all authority. Aside from filth and uncleanliness, he has yet to find anything which might stir him to any high enthusiasm. As he begins the more demanding parts of his life, he falls into the ruts he has learned from his father. He wanders about, comes home heaven knows when, beats the tattered creature who was once his mother, curses God and the world, and finally he is sentenced to a prison for juvenile delinquents. Here he gets his final polish. His fellow citizens are astonished at his lack of national enthusiasm. They see theater and movies, trashy literature, and yellow press day by day pouring out poison. Then they are surprised at the low morality and the national indifference of the people. They do not realize movie trash, cheap journalism, and the like would never produce the skills needed to recognize the greatness of the fatherland. I finally realize something I had never even dreamed of before. The ability to nationalize a people is primarily a question of creating healthy social conditions that can be used to educate the individual. Only when upbringing and school training have taught a man the political greatness of his own fatherland will he achieve an inner pride that comes from belonging to such a great people. You can fight only for something you love. You can love only what you respect. You can respect only what you know. When my interest in social problems was aroused, I began to study it thoroughly. A world that had been so strange to me before suddenly began to open up. In 1909 and 1910, I no longer needed to earn my daily bread as a laborer. I started working independently as a draftsman and watercolor artist. This line of work was difficult financially. There was barely enough earnings to keep body and soul together. However, it was great in that it was closer to my chosen profession. I was no longer dead tired when I came home from work in the evening, unable to even look at a book without dozing off. My new work paralleled my future profession. As master of my own time, I could now plan it better than before. I painted to earn a living and learn for pleasure. I was also able to round out my understanding of the social problem by building a necessary understanding of the theoretical background. I studied pretty much every book on the subject I could get my hands on, and plunged myself in my own thoughts. My acquaintances must have thought I was more than a little eccentric. I passionately pursued my love of architecture. Along with music, I thought architecture was the queen of arts. It was not work to spend time on it, but the height of happiness. I could read or draw late into the night, and it never made me tired. My faith was strengthened by the dream of a future that would become a reality after all. Even though it took years, I was firmly convinced that I would make my name as an architect. The fact that I also took great interest in anything having to do with politics did not seem especially significant. On the contrary, I felt that was the duty of a thinking people. Anyone who did not actively learn about politics lost all right to criticize or complain. In this area, I continued to read and learned a lot. My definition of reading may be different from the average person's definition. I know people who, quote, read all the time, book after book, word for word, but I would not call them well-read. They do have a mass of knowledge, but their brain does not know how to divide it up and catalog the material they have read. They cannot separate a book and identify what is valuable and what is worthless for them. They retain some in their mind forever, but cannot see or understand the other parts at all. Reading is not an end in itself, but a means to an end. In the first place, it should help to fulfill an individual's personal framework and give each person the tools and materials a man needs in his job or profession, whether it is for daily necessity, simple physical fulfillment, or higher destiny. In the second place, reading should give a man a general picture of the world. In either case, what is read shouldn't simply be stored in the memory like a list of facts and figures. The facts, like bits of a mosaic tile, should come together as a general image of the world, helping to shape this world image in the reader's head. Otherwise, there will be a confusion of information learned, and the worthless mix of facts gives the unhappy possessor an undeserved high opinion of himself. He seriously believes he is cultured and learned, while thinking he has some understanding of life and is knowledgeable simply because he has a stack of books by his bed. Actually, every piece of new information takes him further away from the real world, until often he ends up either in a psychiatric hospital or as a politician in government. No man with this kind of mind can ever retrieve from his jumbled knowledge what is appropriate when he needs it. His intellect is not filled with his own life experiences, but is filled with what he has read in books and what in whatever order the content happened to land in his head. If fate reminded him to correctly use what he has learned in his daily life, it would also have to cite the volume and page, or the poor guy could never find what he needed. But since fate does not do this, these knowledgeable men are embarrassed when it really counts. They search their minds frantically for appropriate comparisons, and usually end up with the wrong idea. If this were not the case, then it would be impossible to understand the political achievements of our learned government heroes in high places, unless we decided they are mischievous and not mentally disturbed. A person who has mastered the art of proper and true reading can read any book, magazine, or pamphlet and immediately spot everything he believes he needs to remember, either because it fits his purpose or because it is generally worth knowing. What he has learned then takes its proper place in his imagination concerning the matter at hand. It can then either correct or complete that image to increase its correctness or clarity in his mind. If life suddenly presents some question that requires examination or solution, the memory stored through this reading method will instantly recall the already imagined picture as a standard and will bring out individual bits of information on the subject which have been retained through decades, and that will be the basis for the intelligence used to clarify or answer the question. Only then is there sense and purpose in reading. A speaker who does not study the materials to back up the issues he deals with will never be able to fight effectively for his opinion when challenged, even if it is absolutely true. In every discussion, his memory will fail him as he stammers to find someone else's words to repeat. He cannot connect to the reasoning he needs to enforce what he says or argue with his opponent. When the result is just a matter of personal ridicule, as with a speaker, this may not be fatal, but it becomes serious if fate places one of these incompetent know-it-alls in a high position, such as a head of state. Then it is serious indeed. Even at a very young age, I was careful to read properly, and this skill has helped me tremendously by improving my memory and my understanding. In this light, my time in Vienna in particular was fruitful and valuable. The experiences of daily life stimulated me to constantly study, being in a position to support reality with theory and to test theory by reality, I was prevented from either suffocating in theories or growing superficial in how I judged reality. My experiences in daily life guided and encouraged me to make a thorough, theoretical study of two vital questions aside from the social problem. Who knows if I would ever have would have ever become absorbed in the doctrines and character of Marxism if my life had not simply rubbed my nose in it. In my youth, I knew almost nothing about social democracy, and what I did know was wrong. I thought it was a good thing that the social democrats were fighting for the right of all men to vote by secret ballot. Even then, my mind told me this had to weaken the hated Habsburg regime. I was also convinced the Austrian state could never be maintained unless it sacrificed the German element living in Austria. Even at the cost of slowly converting the German element to Slavs, there was no guarantee the empire would survive since their ability to preserve a Slavic society is highly doubtful. Therefore, I was excited about any development which I thought would lead to the collapse of this unstable state that has condemned to death the Germanism of 10 million people. The more the language uproar gnawed at the Parliament, the closer the hour of collapse approached for this Babylonian empire, and the closer the freedom of my German-Austrian people came near. Babylonian Empire is a reference to the Tower of Babel story, where the people were cursed to speak different languages and scattered throughout the world, in parenthesis. This was the only way that a return to the old mother country could someday happen. The activities of the Social Democrats did not seem unattractive to me at the time. I thought it was also a good thing that they were trying to improve the living conditions of the working man. At that time, I was still innocent and stupid enough to believe that this could happen. What did repel me was their hostile attitude towards the fight for the preservation of Germanism and their pitiful wooing of the Slavic comrades who were willing to accept this courtship and make concessions. Otherwise, they maintained an arrogance and conceit, which gave these insistent beggars their just reward. At the age of 17, I had become somewhat acquainted with the word Marxism, and I thought socialism and social democracy were identical ideas. Again, the hand of fate opened my eyes to this unprecedented fraud on the people. So far, I had encountered the Social Democratic Party only as a spectator at a few mass demonstrations without gaining any insight into the mindset of its supporters or the nature of its doctrine. Now, at one moment, I met face to face with the results of its training and who supported its world concept. In the course of a few months, I learned something that otherwise may have taken years, an understanding of a disease masquerading as social virtue and the love of one's neighbor, a disease which humanity must free the Earth from, or the Earth would soon be freed of humanity. My first encounter with social democrats was on a construction job. It was not a good situation from the very beginning. My clothes were still in good shape, my language was cultivated, and my manner reserved. I had so much to do in dealing with my own fate that I couldn't trouble myself with the world around me. I was looking for work only to avoid starving, and so that I could educate myself no matter how long it took. I might not have paid any attention to my new surroundings if an event on the third or fourth day had not compelled me to immediately adopt a new attitude. I was asked to join the organized union. My knowledge of the trade union organization at that time was zero. I could not have proved whether or not it was in any way useful. When I was told I must join, I refused. My grounds for refusal were that I did not understand the situation, and I would not be forced to do anything. Maybe this was the reason they did not throw me out immediately. They may have hoped that they could convert me or wear me down within a few days. In either case, they were very mistaken. Within a couple weeks, I had reached the end of my rope. During that time, I gained a better understanding of my surroundings, and no power in the world could have forced me to join an organization whose members acted the way they did. The first few days, I was further annoyed. At noon, some of the men went to nearby bars, while others stayed on the lot and ate their pitiful lunch. These were the married men, whose wives brought them their soup in heavily worn bowls. As their week progressed, their numbers grew. I figured out the reason later. When they finished their soup, they would talk politics. I drank my bottle of milk and ate my piece of bread somewhere out of the way as I cautiously studied my new surroundings or considered my misfortune. Still, I heard more than enough, and it seemed that people crept up beside me deliberately, hoping to force me to make my beliefs clear. In any case, what I heard irritated me to the extreme. They were against everything. The nation. Because they thought it was an invention of the capitalistic classes. I heard that constantly. They were against the fatherland as a tool of the privileged class to exploit the workers, the authority of law as a way to oppress the working class, the schools as an institution to train slaves and slave owners, religion as a means of stupefying the people so they could be exploited, morals as a symbol of stupid, sheep-like patience, etc. There was nothing they didn't drag through the mud. At first, I tried to stay quiet, but finally I could no longer hold my tongue. I began to express my beliefs and contradict them. Then I realized this was useless until I knew more about the points under dispute, so I began to go to the same sources where they drew their supposed wisdom. Book after book, pamphlet after pamphlet, I read them all in their turn. There were often heated arguments on the building lot. I went on struggling, growing more informed than my adversaries were every day, until one day the ultimate method was used that vanquishes reason. Terrorism and violence. Some of the opposition spokesmen forced me either to leave the job at once by choice or to fly off the scaffolding on my head. As I was alone and resistance seemed hopeless, I preferred to follow the former advice, richer by one experience. I left filled with disgust, but at the same time so agitated that it would have been impossible for me to turn my back on the whole affair. No. After the spark of my first indignation, my stiff neck once more got the upper hand. I was absolutely determined to find another construction job just the same. My decision was strengthened by the fact I had eaten up what little earnings I had saved in just a few weeks. I had no choice but to find work. And so the game began all over again, only to end the same way it had before. I struggled with all of this. I had to ask, were these human beings worthy of belonging to a great people? It was a painful question. If the answer were yes, the struggle for a national body was really not worth the effort and sacrifice that the best individuals must make. But if the answer were no, our people were a poor lot as human beings. I was restless and uneasy during those days of brooding and wondering as I saw the mass of non-nationalistic people grow into a menacing crowd. With new, stronger feelings, I watched the endless rows of Vienna workmen marching in a mass demonstration one day. For almost 2 hours, I stood breathless, observing the enormous human serpent twisting its way past me. At last, depressed and uneasy, I left the square and walked home. On the way, in a tobacco shop, I saw the Workers' Times, the official socialist newspaper of the old Austrian Social Democratic Party. It was also available at a cheap cafe where I often went to read the newspapers, but I had never succeeded in bringing myself to read the trash for more than 2 minutes at a time. Its whole tone affected me like intellectual poison. Now, under the depressing effect of the day's demonstration, an inner voice pushed me to buy a copy and read it thoroughly. And so I did that evening, fighting down frequent rage at this concentrated essence of lies. By reading the Social Democratic Press daily, I could study the inner nature of its train of thought better than from any theoretical literature. What a difference there was between the glittering phrases in the theoretical writings about freedom, beauty, and dignity, and these words in the paper created an illusion of profound wisdom with some difficulty due to the disgusting moral tone, all written with a brazen claim of prophecy. The brutal daily press of this doctrine claimed to be the salvation of a new humanity, but it was full of vileness, using every kind of slander, and absolutely full of lies. The theory is intended for stupid dupes of the middle and upper levels of intelligence. The more vile and base sections were targeted at the masses. To me, dwelling on the literature and press of this doctrine and organization meant finding my way back to my own people. What once seemed an impassable gulf now created in me a love greater than ever before. Only a fool, once he knows about this enormous work of corruption, could still condemn the victims. The more independent I became in the next few years, the more my insight grew into the inner causes of social democratic success. Now, I understood the meaning of the brutal demand that only red newspapers be subscribed to, only red meetings be attended, only red books be studied, etc. With sparkling clarity, I saw right in front of me the inevitable result of this doctrine of intolerance. The soul of the great masses of people is receptive to nothing weak or halfway. Like a woman, whose spiritual perceptions are attracted more by the strength of a leader than the reason of a follower, the masses love the ruler more than the follower, and they find more inner satisfaction in a doctrine that tolerates nothing that it itself has not granted approval and freedom. The masses are seldom able to make much use of such freedoms, and are likely to feel neglected if given too much. They are as unconscious of the shamelessness that intellectually terrorizes them as they are of the outrageous mistreatment of their human liberty. After all, they have no clue about the doctrine's internal error. They only see the ruthless strength and brutality of its expression, which they always yield to. If social democracy opposes a more truthful but equally brutal theory, the new theory will win, even if it requires a battle first. In less than 2 years, I had developed a clear understanding of both the doctrine and the technical methods of the social democrats used to propagate it. I realized the infamous intellectual terrorism of this movement targets the privileged class, which is neither morally nor spiritually a match for such attacks. They tell a barrage of lies and slander against the individual adversary it considers most dangerous and keep it up until the nerves of the group being attacked give in, and they sacrifice the hated figure just to have peace and quiet again. But the fools still do not get peace and quiet. The game begins again and is repeated until fear of the villain becomes a hypnotic paralysis. Since the Social Democrats know very well the value of power from their own experience, their storming is directed mainly at those whose character has the same quality. Conversely, they praise every weakling on the other side, cautiously, then loudly, according to the intellectual qualities they see or suspect. They fear an impotent, weak-willed genius less than they fear a forceful nature with only modest intellect. Their highest recommendation goes to weaklings in both mind and nature. They are successful in creating the impression that giving in is the only way to win peace and quiet from them while they quietly, cautiously, but unerringly conquer one position after another, either by quiet extortion or by actual theft, when the public attention is on other things. The public is distracted and either unwilling to be interrupted, or they consider the situation too small to worry about and believe it is not worth provoking the angry foe again. These are tactics planned by exact calculation to exploit every human weakness, and it is almost mathematically sure to be successful unless the other side can learn to fight poison gas with poison gas. To those who are weak in nature, it can only be said that this is a simple question of survival or non-survival. To me, the significance of physical terrorism toward the individual and toward the masses was plain to see. Terrorism on the job, in the factory, in the meeting hall, and at mass demonstrations will always be successful unless equal terrorism opposes it. When the Socialist Party encounters opposition, it screams bloody murder and yells for help from the state, only to get what they want in the end. That is to say, it finds some idiot of a high official who hopes to befriend the Marxists and is willing to crush the current adversary of the Socialist Party to gain the party's favor. The followers' and rebels' success can be understood only by a man who knows the soul of a people, not from books, but from life. While its supporters regard it as a triumph of right for their cause, the beaten opponent usually feels future resistance is pointless. The better I understood the methods of physical terrorism in particular, the more I was able to forgive the hundreds of thousands who had given in to it. This realization is something I am most profoundly grateful for during that period of suffering. It gave me back my people, and I learned to distinguish the victims from the deceivers. The result of this seduction of mankind can only be described as victimization. If in some pictures of life I have drawn the character of these lowest humans, that picture would not be completely without my assurance that in these depths I found light in the form of extraordinary self-sacrifice, faithful comradeship, contentment in adversity, and complete modesty, especially among the older workmen. Even though these virtues were gradually disappearing in the younger generation through the influence of the big city, there were still many whose good, healthy blood overpowered the vileness of life. If, in politics, these kind, honest people failed to join together and fill the ranks instead of our people's deadly enemies, it was because they couldn't and didn't understand the vileness of the new doctrine, and because nobody else bothered to give them any attention, and finally, because social conditions were stronger than any rebellion. Sooner or later, the impoverished were bound to be the victims, and they would be driven into the Social Democrats' camp. Many times, the privileged class, in a clumsy and immoral manner, formed a united front to oppose worker demands that were justifiable and based in fundamental humanity, and they did this without offering any excuse, without any reason. Therefore, even the most decent of workmen was driven from the trade union organization into political activity. Millions of workers were inwardly hostile to the Social Democratic Party at first, but their resistance was overcome by the often pointless and insane way in which the privileged class parties opposed any social demands. The inflexible refusal of reasonable demands such as to improve working conditions, simple safety devices on machines, prevention of child labor, protection for women, at least during the months of pregnancy. This all helped to drive the masses into the nets of social democracy, which gratefully latched on to every case of similar contemptible sentiments. Our politicians, our privileged class, can never rectify these past sins. By resisting all attempts to cure social ills, it sowed hatred and apparently justified the claim that the Social Democratic Party alone represented the interests of the working people. Above all, the privileged class furnished the moral excuse for the existence of the unions, which have always been the greatest suppliers for the Social Democratic Party, or for the Socialist Political Party. During my Vienna apprentice years, I was forced to adopt some beliefs, whether I wanted to or not, regarding the union question. As I considered them an inseparable part of the Social Democratic Party, my decision was swift and wrong. I rejected them without hesitation. In this infinitely important question, fate itself instructed me, and eventually I had to overturn my rash judgment. At 20, I had learned to distinguish between the union as a means to defend the employees' general social rights and to win better living conditions, and the union as a tool of the Socialist Party promoting the political class struggle. The Social Democrats realized the enormous importance of the trade union movement, and that assured them a position of power. Because the privileged class failed to understand this importance, it lost its political position. The privileged class thought they could sweep aside a logical argument by a bold denial, and through political force, push the issue down and make it look like an unreasonable path. It is nonsense and a lie to say any union movement is in itself hostile to the fatherland. The opposite is near the truth. If union activity envisions and attains the goal of improving the position of a class that belongs to the pillars of the nation, its effect is not hostile to state or fatherland, but is national in the truest sense of the word. It is helping to lay the social groundwork necessary to maintain the nation. Without this groundwork, no education is thinkable. The trade union movement gains the highest credit for destroying social cancers by attacking both intellectual and physical toxins, and thus contributing to the general health of the body of the nation. To question whether or not a union is a necessity is really pointless. It is obvious they are necessary. As long as there are employers with little social understanding, or even with a faulty sense of justice and an inability to see what is appropriate, it is not merely the right, but the duty of their employees to protect the public interest against the greed or unreasonable acts of individuals. The preservation of honor and faith in a nation is a national interest just as much as the preservation of the people's health. The nation's faith and public health are seriously threatened by unworthy business operators who do not feel themselves to be members of the people's community. The evil effects of their greed or ruthlessness cause serious harm for the future of the nation and the people. To remove the causes of these problems is a service to the nation. No one can say that every individual is free to walk away from any supposed injustice. No. Such claims must be regarded as an attempt to divert attention from the facts. Correcting bad or antisocial elements is either in the nation's interest, or it is not. If correction is in the interest of the nation, we must make war upon the problems with weapons which offer some promise of success. The individual worker is never in a position to defend himself against the strength of a large enterprise. Therefore, this can never be a question of victory for the cause of right versus wrong, because the justice of the cause can be determined by the one in the position of power. If the decision were based on how just the claim was, people's sense of justice alone would end the dispute honorably and amicably, and then things would never even reach the point of a dispute. If poor treatment drives people to resist, then the struggle can only be decided by superior strength if legal and judiciary machinery are not created to resolve these issues. An unjust enterprise can only be opposed by a group of employees united into a single person if there is to be any hope of victory. The organizing of a union may lead to stronger social ties in daily life, and then to the removal of problems which continue to produce dissatisfaction and complaints. The existing state of dissatisfaction can be blamed on those who have managed to obstruct all attempts at legal regulation by using their political influence. The Social Democrats dug their fingers so deeply into the labor movement that the political privileged class failed to understand, or did not want to understand, the importance of union organization and actively opposed it. In the process of their opposition, they lost sight of their real purpose and began fighting for different objectives. The Social Democrats had no intention of allowing the union movement to continue its original goal. No, that was not what they had in mind. Within a few decades, their trained hands had turned a method of defending human social rights into an instrument for destroying the national economy. The interests of the workers had no place in their plans. Even in politics, the use of economic pressure is a strong extortion tool as long as one side has little or no conscience, and the other side is sufficiently stupid and has sheep-like patience. Presently, both requirements are fulfilled. Even by the turn of the century, the labor union movement no longer served its original purpose. From year to year, it was drawn more and more into the sphere of social democratic politics, until finally, it served only as a battering ram in the class struggle. The Social Democrats assumed that continual blows would make the whole economic structure tumble, then the state, deprived of its economic foundations, would suffer the same fate. The representation of the working people's real interests played less and less a part in the Social Democratic agenda. Eventually, political concerns made relieving the social and cultural problems of the workers undesirable. If the workers were not distressed and were fully satisfied, and their will was no longer fueled by resentment, there would have been a danger that they could no longer be used as an army. Intuitively sensing this development, the leaders of the class struggle fell into such a panic that eventually they simply refused to bring about any beneficial social improvement and actually took a decided stand against any improvement for the workers. There was no need to be embarrassed by such seemingly incomprehensible behavior. They could avoid it by constantly increasing their demands on businesses, which made the rejection of any proposed improvements appear as if the business was engaged in a diabolical attempt to cripple the workers' most sacred rights. Considering the minimum thinking power of the masses, the social democratic success is not surprising. The privileged class camp was outraged by these obviously deceptive social democratic tactics, but they still based their actions on the statements made by the social democrats. The social democrats' fear of raising the working class from its abyss and of cultural and social misery should have led their opponents to make supreme efforts to improve the workers' lives. This would have gradually twisted the weapons from the hands of the socialist leaders of the class struggle, but this did not happen. Instead of attacking and capturing the enemy position of the high moral ground themselves, they preferred to be squeezed and shoved. Finally, in their negotiating battles with the unions, they relented and gave in to changes that, no matter how far-reaching, were insufficient for the socialists. The Social Democrats easily rejected the changes because it was too little, too late. Everything remained the same, except now there was more dissatisfaction than ever among both the workers and the business owners. Even then, the free trade union already hung like a menacing storm cloud on the political horizon and loomed over the existence of everyone. It was one of the worst terrorist instruments against the security and independence of the national economy, against the unity of the state, and against the freedom of individuals. This turned the idea of democracy into a ridiculous and disgusting cliché. It was an outrage against freedom and forever mocked the idea of brotherhood, as demonstrated in the saying, "If you will not be a comrade too, it means a broken skull for you." This is how I came to understand mankind. Through the years, my views broadened and deepened, but there was no need to change my way of thinking. The more I understood the outer nature of social democracy, the more I longed to understand the inner core of the doctrine. The official party literature was not very useful here. It is incorrect in both details and in the proof it offers for economic questions. It is also untruthful in its discussion of political aims. Besides, I was especially repelled by the dishonest and unethical manner in which it was presented. Sentences are written using a lot of vague words with unintelligible meanings that are as clever as they are senseless. Only those unconventional types rotting among us could possibly feel at home in this intellectual maze. They scrape some spiritual experience from this artsy literary manure, and the message is assisted by the humility of our people who think something is deep and wise just because they don't understand it. I gradually built a clear picture of its intent by balancing the theoretical truth and nonsense of this doctrine with its actual outward appearance. When I began to understand, fear and horror crept over me. I saw a teaching compounded by ego and hatred, which, according to mathematical law, could very well lead to victory, but would then lead to the end of humanity as well. During this time, I learned about the connection between this doctrine of destruction and the nature of a people. Up until now, this was unknown to me. A knowledge of the Jews is the necessary key to grasping the real intentions of social democracy. If a person knows these people, the mask of delusion hiding their aims and the meaning of the party falls from his eyes, and the ape-like face of Marxism grins at him. As it speaks, a fog of social talk flows from the ugly smirk on its face. Today, I still find it difficult, if not impossible, to remember when the word Jew first developed a special meaning for me. I do not remember ever hearing the word mentioned at home during my father's lifetime. I think the old gentleman would have considered it uncultured or antiquated to emphasize the designation at all. In the course of his life, he developed a mixed bag of views which had survived in me along with my extreme nationalist sentiments and colored my feelings. At school, there was nothing to change the ideas I received at home. I did meet a Jewish boy in secondary school whom we all treated with caution, but only because experience had taught us to mistrust him due to his quietness. None of us thought much about this. I didn't encounter the word Jew very often, not until I was 14 or 15, and then primarily in connection with political talks. I felt a slight aversion to it, and could not help but have an unpleasant feeling when I became involved in religious arguments. But at that time, I did not see any other significance. The city of Linz only had a few Jews. In the course of centuries, they had become outwardly Europeanized and looked human. In fact, I even thought they were Germans. I did not realize the nonsense behind this notion, because I believed their only distinguishing mark was a strange religion. Persecution for their religion and hostile comments against them often brought my objection in return. I had no idea that organized hostility against the Jews even existed. Then I came to Vienna. I was fascinated by the architecture and preoccupied with my own fate. At first, I was not concerned with the classes of people in the large city. Although there were already nearly 200,000 Jews among the 2 million people of Vienna, I did not see them. My eyes and mind could not grasp all the values and ideas in the first few weeks. Only when I began to settle in, did I begin to look more closely at my new world and see a busy scene more clearly. That's when I encountered the Jewish question. I cannot say that the way I encountered it was particularly agreeable. At first, I only saw the religious aspect of the Jew, and for reasons of human tolerance, I maintained my opposition to religious attacks. The tone of the anti-Semitic press in Vienna seemed unworthy of the cultural tradition of a great people. I was bothered by the memory of certain happenings in the Middle Ages which I did not want to see repeated. All through the Middle Ages, Jews were blamed for any bad occurrence and killed by thousands at the time. Some cities blamed them for the Black Death Plague, some areas exiled them or forced them into ghettos, others required them to wear yellow cloth armbands or buttons, and they were restricted from certain fields of work all throughout the Middle Ages. End parenthesis. Since the newspapers in question were not generally considered among the most outstanding quality, I thought they were the product of angry envy rather than the result of a principle, even if it was wrong. My belief was strengthened by what I considered the infinitely more dignified and commendable way in which the truly great newspapers answered those attacks. They did not even mention them, but responded with silence. I eagerly read the World Press, the New Free Press, Vienna newspaper, the Vienna Daily Newspaper, Wiener Tagblatt, etc., and I was astonished at how much they offered the reader and at their objectivity. I also admired their dignified tone. Occasionally, I did not like their pretentious style, but I thought it might be more acceptable in the bustle of the cosmopolitan city. Since I considered Vienna such a city, I thought this amateur explanation might be a sufficient excuse. But the way these newspapers played up the stories in the royal court's favor did repel me more than once. There was rarely an event at the Hofburg Imperial Palace, the palace of the Habsburg dynasty in Vienna, Austria, which was not told to the reader in tones of enraptured ecstasy or grief-stricken sorrow. When an event dealt with the wisest monarch of all times, it read almost like a mating dance between lovers. The whole theme seemed so fake. I thought that such a policy was a stain on the ideal of liberal democracy, the way they would crawl for the court's approval and betray the dignity of the nation. This was the first bad feeling I developed about the press. As always, I followed every event in Germany with burning concentration, whether political or cultural. With proud admiration, I compared the rise of the Reich with the sickness and decline of the Austrian state. Happenings outside Austria were mostly a source of pure pleasure. The less agreeable events at home often brought worry and gloom. I did not approve of the fight then being carried out against Wilhelm II, the German emperor and king of Prussia under the Revolution. I saw him not only as the German emperor, but primarily as the creator of a German navy. I was extraordinarily annoyed when the German parliament forbade the emperor to speak in parliament. The prohibition came from a people who had no reason to object, considering the fact that these parliamentary geese chattered more nonsense in a single session than a whole dynasty of emperors could produce in centuries. I was outraged that the heir of the imperial crown could receive reprimands from the shallowest chattering institution in a state where every half-wit claimed to the right to criticize and might even be turned loose on a nation as a lawgiver. But I was even more angered when the Vienna press, which bowed to the lowest member of the royal court hoping for some attention, now expressed doubts about the German emperor. Their apparent concern seemed more like malice, in my opinion. They quickly claimed they had no intention of meddling in the affairs of the German emperor, heaven forbid, but they pretended that touching a delicate spot in such a friendly way, they were fulfilling a duty resulting from their mutual alliance between the two countries, and at the same time discharging their obligations of journalistic truthfulness. Then the finger pushed into the sore spot and dug ruthlessly into the wound. Cases like this made the blood rush to my head. This was what gradually made me regard the great press with more caution. I did have to admit that one of the anti-Semitic papers, the German People's Paper, Das Deutsche Volksblatt, was honorable on occasion. Another thing that bothered my nerves was the revolting cult of France, which the big papers were then propagating. It was enough to make a person ashamed of being a German. We were constantly bombarded with phrases with praises to the great civilized nation. More than once, this wretched spell of French captivation made me lay down one of the world papers. In fact, I began to turn to the German People's Paper more often, which was much smaller, but cleaner in such matters. I disliked the sharp anti-Semitic tone, but I did occasionally read arguments which gave me something to think about. Such stories eventually educated me about the man and the movement which then governed Vienna's destiny, Dr. Karl Lueger and the Christian Socialist Party. Karl Lueger was a member of the Christian Socialist Party, which was an anti-Semitic party. He was also the mayor of Vienna in 1897 to 1910, which made him mayor until Hitler was almost 21 years old. End parenthesis. When I came to Vienna, I was hostile to both. In my eyes, the man and the movement were opposed to political and social change. However, a sense of common justice forced me to change my opinion gradually as I learned about the man and his work. Eventually, my opinion grew into admiration. Today, more than ever, I consider the man the greatest German mayor of all times. But how many of my preconceived views were upset by this change in attitude towards the Christian Socialist movement? My opinions on anti-Semitism also slowly changed with the passing of time, and this was the most difficult change I ever went through. It was the most difficult of all my spiritual struggles. Only after battling for months between understanding and feelings did this voice of reason finally win. 2 years later, feelings followed understanding, and from then on, understanding was the most faithful watchman and guardian I could have with me. During my bitter struggle between emotional ties to what I learned as a child and cold reason, the streets of Vienna offered me priceless first-hand lessons. The time had come when I no longer walked blindly through the vast city as I did at first. I kept my eyes open and looked at people as well as buildings. Once, as I was strolling through the inner city, I suddenly met a figure in a long caftan with black curls. Is that a Jew? Was my first thought. Jews did not look like that in Linz. I covertly observed the man, but the longer I stared at that alien face, scrutinizing feature after feature, my question changed from, "Is that a Jew?" to, "Is that a German?" As always, I tried to resolve my doubts through books. For a few coins, I bought the first anti-Semitic pamphlets I had ever purchased in my life. Unfortunately, they were all based on the theory that the reader grasped, or at least was familiar in principle, with the Jewish question. Their tone made me feel new doubts because of the often shallow and unscientific proofs that they offered. I would relapse to my former way of thinking for weeks, sometimes months. The matter seemed so monstrous, and the accusations so unrestrained, that I feared it might be unjust for me to decide one way rather than another, and again I became timid and uncertain. Even I could no longer doubt that this was a question about people in itself, and not about Germans of a particular religious persuasion. Since I had begun to occupy myself with the question, and to pay attention to the Jew, Vienna had appeared to me in a new light. Wherever I went now, I saw Jews, and the more I saw, the more clearly my eye distinguished them from other people. The inner city and the districts north of the Danube Canal were especially filled with people who didn't look anything like Germans. If I had continued to have my doubts, my indecision was ended by the attitude of the Jews themselves. A great movement among many of them, especially in Vienna, sharply emphasized the special character of Jewry as a separate people. Zionism. Only some of the Jews approved of this movement, and while the great majority condemned even rejected the very idea, the appearance of the movement melted away in an evil fog of excuses. I could even say lies. So-called liberal Jewry rejected the Zionists as Jews who were impractical and perhaps dangerous in their public adherence to Judaism. It made no difference; they were still all Jews. There was no real separation, and they maintained their internal solidarity. This fictitious conflict between the Zionists and the liberal Jews soon disgusted me. It was false through and through, and contradicted to the moral dignity and pure character their race had always prided itself on. Morality and purity of character were terms that had their own meaning among these people anyway. It was obvious from their unclean appearance that they were not water lovers. I'm sorry to say that this was very clear, even with my eyes closed. I was frequently nauseated by the smell from these caftan wearers. In addition, their clothes were dirty, and they generally looked poor. All this was unattractive enough by itself, but one was positively repelled when they realized uncleanliness went beyond personal filth and into the moral mudstains of these people. My greatest concern was the activities of the Jews in certain fields of life. I slowly penetrated this mystery. Was there any shady undertaking, any form of foulness, especially in cultural life, in which at least one Jew did not participate? If you carefully punctured this abscess with a knife, like a maggot in a rotten body who was blinded by the sudden influx of life, you would discover a kike, ein Judlein. I saw a great burden of guilt fall upon Jewry when I came to understand how it controlled the press, the influence in art, in literature, and the theater. All their slimy declarations now meant little or nothing. It was enough to look at one of the billboard pillars and study the names credited for the awful movie or theatrical presentations in order to be firmly convinced of the Jewish problem. Here they were, infecting the people with a pestilence, an intellectual pestilence worse than the Black Death of ancient days. This poison was produced and distributed in massive quantities, too. Naturally, the more immoral these artists and producers are, the more they grow. Such a fellow flings his garbage in the face of humanity like a windmill. Do not forget their unlimited number, for every one German writer like Goethe, nature plants at least 10,000 of these slimy creatures in the pelt of humanity where they poison the people with their disease. It was a dreadful but inescapable fact that the Jew seemed specially chosen by nature in tremendous numbers for this horrible destiny. Are we supposed to assume that this is the way he is chosen? At that time, I began to carefully examine the names of all the producers of these unclean products in the world of art, and this scrutiny only damaged my attitude towards the Jews more. Though my feelings were outraged at times, I must surrender to my reason and let it draw the conclusions. It was true that 9/10 of all literary filth, artistic trash, and theatrical nonsense must be attributed to a people consisting scarcely of 1/100th of the country's population. It was a plain fact. I now began to scrutinize even my beloved newspapers from the world press. The deeper I probed, the more my previous admiration shrank. The style grew more intolerable. I objected to the content as flat and shallow. The objectivity was transformed into more of a lie than honest truth. Of course, the authors were Jews. A thousand things which I had once barely noticed now struck me as remarkably obvious, while others, which had merely given me something to think about, I began to grasp and understand. I now could see the liberal sentiments of this press in a new light, the dignified tone in replying to attacks, as well as the silent responses, now revealed a trick as shrewd as it was low. Their enraptured theatrical criticisms always favored a Jewish author, while their disapproval never fell on anyone except a German. The constant and quiet sneering at William II revealed they had a deliberate plan. Their advocacy of French culture and civilization also played into their schemes. The trashy content of the short stories now became an indecency, and I heard sounds of an alien people in the language. The general sense was so clearly harmful to everything German that it could only be intentional. But who had an interest in this? Was it all mere chance? Gradually I became unsure. My development was accelerated by the insights I gained into a series of other matters. This was the general display of manners and morals openly shown by most of Jewry. The street again offered some ugly, truly ugly object lessons. The relationship of Jewry to prostitution, and, even more, to white slavery, could be studied in Vienna more so than in probably any other Western European city, with the possible exception of southern French seaport towns. If a person walked the streets and alleys of Leopoldstadt, Leopoldtown, in the evening, all along the way, you could see things which remained hidden from the great majority of German people. Leopoldstadt is a district in Vienna separated from the main city by the Danube waterways. The area was heavily Jewish and considered a ghetto. End parentheses. These things remained secret until the First World War gave the soldiers on the Eastern Front an opportunity, or rather, forced them to see similar happenings. It sent a chill down my spine when I first realized the Jew was the manager of this immoral trade among the scum of the city. He was icy calm and shamelessly businesslike, which made me fuming angry. Now I no longer evaded discussing the Jewish question. Now I wanted to discuss it. I had seen the Jew in every area of cultural and artistic life, and then I suddenly encountered him in another spot where I would have least expected to see him, and I recognized the Jew as the leader of social democracy, the Marxists, and that is when the blinders fell from my eyes. Suddenly, a long spiritual struggle came to an end. I was astonished how easily my fellow workmen changed their minds over a question. Often their opinion changed within a few days, sometimes even within a few hours, they turned around. I could hardly understand how people who individually held reasonable views could suddenly lose them the moment they came under the spell of the masses. It was enough to drive a person crazy. I would argue for hours, and finally believe I had broken the ice or cleared up some piece of nonsense they had in their heads. I would feel pride in my success, and then the next day I would be stressed to find out I had to begin all over again. It had all been for nothing. Their crazy opinions seemed to always swing like a pendulum. I could understand how they felt. They were dissatisfied with their place in life. They cursed fate, which often dealt them such hard knocks. They hated the businessmen, who seemed to be heartless tools of fate, and criticized government offices, which in their eyes had no sympathy for the workers' situation. They demonstrated against food prices and marched through the streets in support of their demands. All this I could understand. But what I could not understand was the boundless hatred they felt for their own nation, the way they despised its grandeur, the way they defiled its history, and the way they dragged Greg men in the gutter. This struggle against their own kind, their own nest, their own homeland, was as senseless as it was incomprehensible. It was unnatural. They could temporarily be cured of this vice, but only for days or for weeks at the most. Later, if one met a supposed convert, he may have fallen back into his old self against his fellow men. His unnatural tendencies would again have him in their grip. I gradually came to realize that the social democratic press consisted mostly of Jews, but I attached no particular importance to this situation. Circumstances were the same at the other newspapers. One thing was remarkable to me. There was not one paper where Jews worked that I would have considered a proud national voice that was in line with my concept of national pride. I forced myself to at least make an attempt to read this Marxist journalism, but the more I did, the more I disliked it. I now tried to get closer to the manufacturers of these mischievous words. From the editor on down, they were all Jews. I picked up every social democratic pamphlet I could and looked up the author's name, Jews. I noticed the names of almost all the leaders. Most of them were also members of the chosen people, the Jews, whether they were representatives in the government or secretaries of the unions, chairmen of organizations, or street agitators. The same uncanny picture was continually repeated. I will never forget the names of Austerlitz, David, Adler, Ellen Bogen, and others. One thing was plain to me now. The leadership of the party whose petty representatives I had to fight my most violent battles with for months consisted almost exclusively of an alien people. I then had the happy satisfaction of knowing for certain that the Jew was no German. Now, for the first time, I became thoroughly familiar with the corrupter of our people. Living 1 year in Vienna had been enough to convince me that no worker is too inflexible to yield to greater knowledge and superior enlightenment. I had gradually become an authority on their own doctrine, which I used as a weapon in the battle for my convictions. Success was almost always on my side. The great mass of people could be saved, even if it was only by the greatest sacrifice of time and patience, but no Jew could ever be freed from his opinion. In those days, I was still child enough that I would try to explain the madness of their doctrines to them. In my own little circle, I talked until my tongue was sore and my throat was hoarse, and thought I must succeed in convincing them how destructive their Marxist madness was. But the very opposite was the result. Growing insight into the destructive effect of social democratic theories only increased these people's determination. The more disputes I had with them, the better acquainted I became with their arguing techniques. This is a familiar part for most of us. First, they would count on the stupidity of their adversaries, and then, if there was no way out, they pretended to be stupid themselves. If all else failed, they claimed they did not understand, or, being challenged, they would instantly jump to another subject and talk about obvious truths. If these were agreed on, they immediately applied them to the conversation, and claimed they had no knowledge. Oh, no, I'm sorry, I skipped a line. If these were agreed on, they immediately applied them to entirely different matters. When they were caught off guard, they would avoid the conversation and claim they had no knowledge or understanding of the issue. No matter where you seized one of these apostles, your hand grasped slimy ooze, which spurted through your fingers only to unite again in the next moment. If your argument really gave a man a shattering defeat in front of others, he could do nothing but agree. You might suppose that this was one step forward, but how surprised you would be the following day. The next morning you would find that that Jew has not even the slightest memory of yesterday, and continues to repeat his old mischievous nonsense as if nothing at all has happened. When pressed about the previous conversation, he would pretend astonishment, and could remember nothing at all except the truth of his statements, which he felt had been proven the day before. Frequently I was simply paralyzed. It was hard to know what to admire the most, their fluency or their artistry in lying. Gradually, I began to hate them. There was one good result in all of this. My love for my own people was bound to grow just as fast as the expansion of social democracy. After all, considering the diabolical skillfulness of these seducers, who could possibly condemn their poor victims? It was unbelievably difficult for me to master and overcome the contradictory lies of this race. Any success with people who twisted the truth was immediately turned around. They would make a statement one moment to counter your argument, then the next moment use the same reasons they had just tried to discredit in order to prove their own point. No. The better I became acquainted with the Jew, the more I could forgive the worker. In my opinion, those to blame were not the workers. The blame fell squarely on those who did not think it worthwhile to sympathize with their own kinsfolk. With those who would not give to the hard-working son of the national family that was his by the national family what was his by the iron logic of justice. The blame fell on the same seducer and corrupter who should be placed against the wall. Stimulated by the experience of daily life, I now began to search for the sources of the Marxist doctrine itself, now that I had come to understand its effect in detail. Every day, its success caught someone's attention, and with a little imagination, I could see where the results were leading us. The only question remaining was whether the founders had foreseen the results of their creation in its final form, or whether they were victims of error. I felt that both answers were possible. On one hand, it was the duty of every thinking person to force his way into the front ranks of the cursed movement and try to prevent it from going to extremes. On the other hand, the actual creators of this national disease must have been true devils. Only in the brain of a monster, not a human being, could an organization's plan take shape that would eventually result in the collapse of human civilization and the desolation of the world. If this were the case, the last hope was battle. A battle by every weapon which the human mind, understanding, and will could grasp, no matter who fate blessed. I began to familiarize myself with the founders of this doctrine in order to study the foundations of the movement. I was able to obtain results sooner than I had even dared to hope because of my new, if not yet profound, knowledge of the Jewish question. That alone allowed me to compare its realities with the theoretical shuffling by the founding apostles of this social democracy movement. It had taught me well, or it had taught me to understand the language of the Jewish people, who speak to conceal, or at least veil, their thoughts. Their real purpose is often not in the writing itself, but sleeping snugly between the lines. This was a time when my spirit experienced the greatest upheaval it has ever endured. I turned away from a weak set of political notions and into a fanatical anti-Semite. Once more, and for the last time, restless, uneasy, and oppressive thoughts came to me in my extreme anxiety. I had researched the work of the Jewish people during long periods of human history, and suddenly I was struck by the alarming question of whether the mysteries of fate had irrevocably determined that the final victory was not the destiny of our little people for reasons unknown to we puny humans. The Jews are a people which live for this earth alone. Could they have been promised the earth as their reward? Do we have an objective right to fight for self-preservation, or is this just an illusion? I buried myself in the teachings of Marxism and gave calm, clear consideration to the work of the Jewish people. Fate itself gave me my answer. The Jewish doctrine of Marxism denies the noble goal of nature and sets mass and dead weight numbers in place of the eternal privilege of strength and power. It denies the value of personality in man, disputes the significance of nation and race, it deprives mankind of the essentials of its survival and civilization. As a founder of the universe, Marxism would be the end of any order conceivable to man. The results of applying such a law could only be chaos. Destruction would be the only result for the inhabitants of this planet. If, through his Marxist faith, the Jew conquers the people of this world, his crown will be the death and destruction of all mankind. Earth would again move, uninhabited, through space as it did millions of years ago. Hitler originally said thousands of years ago in the first edition, but it was changed in the second printing, although it could be considered correct either way because he was talking about humanity. End parenthesis. Eternal nature takes revenge for violation of her commandments. I believe I am acting today in the spirit of the Almighty Creator. By standing guard against the Jew, I am defending the work of the Lord.